look at the economic and environmental headwinds of the $18 billion pulp and paper industry in Wisconsin, dating back about 175 years. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer. Ken, glad you could be here. A state DNR report last year found the industry employs about 30,000 people and that for every one job, it generated an additional two jobs in other sectors of the economy. Join in all aspects of the paper products industry, 800-642-1234. Scott Suter is president of the Wisconsin Paper Council. That's the trade group advocating for the interests of pulp and paper. Served for 14 years in the state assembly. Scott, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. So the council is one of dozens of groups around the country to win this $500,000 planning grant from the federal Build Back Better Act Challenge grant program. Can you start by giving us a read on what is the current state of the industry?
Sure. Well, we're very, very pleased that we were able to achieve and be awarded the phase one portion of the Build Back Better Regional Challenge Grant. That's in coalition with our coalition. And we've got a very, very strong coalition that the Paper Council is leading, but we're very, very pleased with our incredible partnership that includes and encompasses about 35 counties in the state of Wisconsin. We partner with Mid-State Technical College, the Great Lakes Timber Professionals Association, Menominee Tribal Enterprises, University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point, the Sustainable Resource Institute, and of course the DNR's Division of Forestry. The status of paper and paper products in the forestry industry here is strong. We, as you stated, there's about $18 billion in terms of manufacturing output here in Wisconsin as a result of the papermaking industry and the supply chain, employs over 30,000 men and women, and the industry is highly technologically advanced, very, very diversified in terms of the products it produces. Many of these mills are the lifeblood of their communities and, you know, are very significant contributors both to communities, community development, but also the environment in terms of protecting the environment. As you know, papermaking is it's paper and forestry products. It's sustainable. It's renewable. This is a recyclable product. And, it's really because it's been so diversified, because the products are very diversified, Wisconsin continues to lead the nation in paper producing, and we intend to stay that way. So the industry is strong. We've had some setbacks over the few years, but as you know, we've had two major investments just recently, a $500 million new mill, Green Bay Packaging in Green Bay, Wisconsin, and now another $500 million investment by Georgia Pacific. So
okay, let's
industry strong.
Yeah, let's break some of this down, and we're going to get to the environmental aspects in a moment. But early on, you said the word supply chain, or I guess two words, huh? I think pandemic. And so how have you seen mills adjusting in these pandemic times as we have also seen huge supply chain issues?
Yes, obviously our industry, like many, many others and many other manufacturers, had experienced some setbacks, certainly during the pandemic. But our industry was able to respond because of the strength of the industry here in Wisconsin and because of the supply chain product. And in terms of working together, our industry was able to continue to deliver the products that we use every day. And it's a huge diversity of products. You have paper products are included in almost every portion of our daily lives, from paper toweling to airlines to aerospace to even your cell phones. So we were able to pivot and continue to produce those products and, more importantly, get those products to market. There were some glitches, but, you know, because our industry was prepared and working 24/7 and still maintaining the safety of our employees, we were able to continue to produce those products, both for the state of Wisconsin and for the entire nation, if not the world.
talking with Scott Suter, president of the Wisconsin Paper Council. You can join in, Pulp and Paper Industry, 800-642-1234. I want to look more closely at some mills. And before we go to Rapids and Verso, I want to look at Combined Locks, a mill in near Appleton, formerly Appleton Coated, then Midwest Paper Group. Now it's like McKinley Paper. And every time a mill changes hands, there is risk, there is volatility, especially volatility for workers to figure out what new owners value and whether they will have a job or not. How do you stop the churn of mills being bought and sold and shuttered and partly shuttered?
Yeah, it's. I think sometimes in terms of mills, particularly when you mention now McKinley, there is opportunity. I think the McKinley purchase of what was formerly Midwest Paper and formerly Appleton Coated actually strengthens that mill. And I think you're going to see future opportunities as a result, not only for the workers, but also for the industry. So sometimes those changes do create opportunities and actually help to save those jobs and actually produce more jobs. If you look at the $500 million investment of Greenia Packaging in terms of their new mill, which actually, by the way, is a net zero mill in terms of net zero utilizing zero water. There are opportunities both environmentally and economically. And yes, there have been setbacks, but that's why our council and our coalition is working so hard to go after and hopefully achieve the Build Back Better regional challenge grant, because that's going to help not only diversify our industry, but it's also going to be used to focus on innovation and future markets and research and development for the entire forest products industry. So there are opportunities on the horizon, and we just have to make sure that the industry is strong and continues to respond to challenges like the pandemic that you mentioned.
Let's bring in Kathy in Madison, who wants to bring up the grant. Hi, Kathy, go ahead.
Hi, I just had a question. If Wisconsin Paper Council does win Phase 2 grant, what would that money be used for?
And Phase 2 being $100 million, is that right, Scott?
It's up to $100 million.
Okay, up to. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you, Kathy, for that question. The grant, if and it's not just the Paper Council that would win, it's our coalition. It really is a very, very strong and diverse coalition. So we're all working together as one to achieve and vie for and hopefully achieve this Build Back Better grant. But really, it's like I mentioned, it's going to be used to focus on innovation and future market research, research and development on many, many fronts. So we have a plan in place that will help not only sustain the forest products industry for the future, but it's also going to make certain that, you know, we help our rural communities. This our grant application is truly rural focused, focuses on diversity and increasing workforce skills and participation, and really are increasing and improving our capacity to drive innovation and protect our workforce as well. So there's a lot of components to the grant. I think it's probably over 200 to 300 pages. Our coalition team has worked very, very hard to make not only this grant viable, but to make it work for rural underserved communities and to strengthen and continue to make our industries and our supply chain sustainable.
Scott Suter leads the Wisconsin Paper Council, represents the state's paper mills, papermaking industry. Join in from your vantage point about this sector of the economy, how it affects you, 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute with Scott Suter here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the future of Wisconsin's paper industry on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Swedish pulp and paper manufacturer Billerud Korsnäs recently completed its acquisition of Verso. But what happens to the Rapids mill that had employed hundreds of people, that remains unclear. The Swedish firm's CEO told the Rapids Tribune that the mill was the largest minor asset in the acquisition. Scott Suter here, president of the Wisconsin Paper Council, with us for about 10 more minutes. Let's bring in Maya now in Madison. Hi, Maya. What is your question about the industry?
Hi, good morning. My question is related to equity and diversity, two topics that are very, very important to me. I'm curious if the grant addresses these.
Thank you, Maya. Scott.
Well, thank you, Maya, for that question. And the answer is a resounding yes. Diversity and equity and inclusion are a major point, not only of our grant, it's a requirement from the Build Back Better Regional Challenge. And really one of the overarching goals of our application, our coalition application, is to do everything we can and create a plan to lift up the socioeconomic opportunities for our underserved rural areas. So, and we also have fantastic partners in the Menominee Tribal Enterprises group as part of our coalition. So we're not only partnering with the key individuals and entities that are truly believe in equity and inclusion, but also we're listening to the rural voices out there and making certain that we value and those rural communities and those individuals that reside in the rural communities. It's a very, very important component of our application. And we're just very, very honored and very honored to have Menominee Tribal Enterprises as a part of our coalition.
Yes, a little more there. Yes, a little more there, I'm wondering, because you're developing some new uses for maple wood. What is happening there exactly in that partnership?
So this is, in terms of our grant application, developing new opportunities, new uses, new research, and hopefully new products, but also new opportunities for Menominee Tribal Enterprises and others to diversify their product and produce and create research and development in those areas in terms of maple. So part of the Build Back Better Regional Challenge application that we have is to do research and development and create new products, new opportunities, and hopefully perhaps some new products out of maple research. So we're using the not only heritage and honoring the heritage of Menominee Tribal Enterprises, but also making certain that groups like that are prepared for the future and have a very sustainable product and opportunities. So really, it's one component of the Build Back Better application, but a very important component in terms of research and development to protect the industry, to make certain there's opportunities for rural communities going forward.
Maya, thank you. Scott, as you look at your application and as you look at your work in the rural areas, what are your plans to help Wisconsin Rapids and the milling industry there and the people who were employed at Verso? What are you working on there?
So we've worked in coalition in terms of the Paper Council. We worked with local officials, state officials, really the community to do everything we can to convince the new owners of the former Verso mill, that this mill is important. Not only their jobs are important, but the mill is important to the entire supply chain here in Wisconsin. So we're working with both Democrats and Republicans in terms of the legislature and, like I said, local officials to do everything we can to continue to convince the Swedish company of the importance of this mill, both to the community and to the state and to them.
And that's interesting because, you know, when the new owner looks at your asset in the community as a minor asset in their portfolio, how do you raise its value?
You know, we do everything we can to work with others to convince the new company of the importance. But also, you know, in terms of the Build Back Better, if we do, if we are able to win this grant award, the research and development that's going to result as a result of that opportunity will help not only the Rapids Mill, but others throughout the state. So hopefully, we can combine the research and development and the innovation for the future, should we achieve this grant, to do what we can to help mills that are struggling. We also, we've worked, again, we're also encouraging for the future, the state legislature to work on a fund that would assist mills like this in the future in terms of, for the industry, sort of an emergency fund. So if you look at our strategic plan that we worked on with UW Oshkosh, one of the recommendations that came out of that plan, that two-year plan, is to create a fund that, like Maine has, to work with industries, work with during times of crisis to assist so that we can not necessarily prevent situations like the Rapids Mill, but help out in the future and be better prepared to respond to those types of crises.
How much money would be in an emergency fund like this, and who would put up the money?
We haven't really flushed that out, but if you look at Maine, they have a $20 million fund, and that's reserved, and there are metrics involved, and Maine is ahead of the game in terms of making certain that they are protecting their forest products industry. So, we want to work with Democrats and Republicans in the legislature, and of course, the governor in the state of Wisconsin, to develop a plan that can work for the entire forest products industry in times of crisis. Hmm. So if Maine can do it, I think Wisconsin can do it. We want to continue to maintain our status as the number one paper producing state in the entire nation. And I think we can do it, but it's going to take a lot of effort, and it's going to take Democrats and Republicans working together. But I'm convinced that we can get there, and I know that we've got a lot of interest in it.
Scott Suter with us, president of the Wisconsin Paper Council. Let's take another question now from Steve in Milton. Hi, Steve. Go ahead. Hi, Steve. Are you there? Oh, I think we have.
Yes, sorry about that.
There we go. Get off that mute button, Steve. We all do it. Go ahead.
I was just up north. I saw a lot of timber trucks moving product. I was just curious what the process is to replenish the forest after the trees have been removed.
So, Steve, thanks for the question. It's all about managing forest land, and we work with foresters. We work with groups like the Great Lakes Timber Professionals Association to make sure that we are properly managing our forest land here in Wisconsin. And the false narrative out there is that we're cutting down trees and we're losing trees. That's just not true. We have more trees than we've had 100 years ago, and we make certain, because obviously trees are our core staple of our industry. We make certain that we are properly managing our forest land, working with landowners, working with foresters, working with the DNR to keep our forests strong. And that involves a great deal of work and effort in terms of managing that forest land. But we work hand in hand with regulators to do that. So it's very, very, we're very, very strong in terms of our forestry management here in Wisconsin. We're very, very proud of that.
As we look at the environmental piece of this, PCBs in past decades, mills in Wisconsin released an estimated 700,000 pounds of PCBs into the Fox River. That's where we had the cleanup. Justice Department involved $1 billion there over 17 years. What is happening in the industry? Is there some truth to the perception that the paper industry is a dirty industry?
There is absolutely no truth to that at all. In fact, the industry has responded to those challenges and helped and done everything it can, and have worked hand in hand with regulators to clean up those PCBs. But now the industry is very, very environmentally friendly. If you look at the water coming in to mills, it's actually cleaner going out than it is coming in. We're a heavily regulated industry, but also heavily invested in terms of environmental sustainability. One, because consumers are demanding it, but two, because it's the right thing to do. Our 30,000 workers live, play, and work and raise their families in these communities. They care very deeply about the environment and where they live, and want to leave a better earth and a better environment as their legacy. So really, the industry has responded. It's very technologically advanced now. And, you know, we meet or in most cases exceed both federal and state regulations in terms of environmental quality. We're very proud of that status. Like I said, it's the industry is renewable, recyclable, and very importantly, sustainable. And we intend to stay that way and working toward the future and innovation and diversification to make sure that we're sustainable for the future.
Scott, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Scott Suter is president of the Wisconsin Paper Council, which represents paper mills, the paper-making industry. We have a link to the council's new report on the state of the paper industry that was produced by UW-Oshkosh. It's at wpr.org/mornings. Just ahead, we look at the federal effort to ban one of Wisconsin's other industries, mink farming. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. We explore the demand for fur across the world and what happens to mink pelt production in Wisconsin in light of the COVID outbreaks on mink farms early on in the pandemic. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Also, new reports have surfaced by National Geographic and the Detroit Free Press documenting animal-human spillover cases. We'll get to that. According to the Trade Group Fur Commission USA, Wisconsin leads the nation, generating well over 1 million pelts a year. What questions come up for you about mink farms and the industry? 800-642-1234. Charles Hobbs is Executive Director of Fur Commission USA. Charles, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Yes, let's look first at these developments about the animal-to-human COVID transmission here in the U.S. Four people infected were from Michigan who likely got the virus from mink. What has been your response from farmers? What are you hearing?
Yeah, so, you know, I guess the response is we know that, like, you know, mink and other species, you know, and like cats, dogs, tigers, lions, non-human primates, white-tailed deer, and others can get COVID. And they all have the potential to spread it to humans. So it's not something that I would say is unexpected. And so it's, I think to the public, it can be a little, it can seem unexpected, but in the scientific community, it's not, you know, three out of four of the emerging diseases are, you know, we get from animals. So it's pretty typical in science.
Well, there was something surprising out of this because we learned through National Geographic that the CDC hid the mink to human spillover information. How would this news change the way that you work with and support mink farmers in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so we, you know, we're as an organization, and the farmers, we all try to be really good stewards of the mink, of the animals, of the land. And part of that process is we have within our organization to support the farmers, we have veterinarians that the first thing a farmer does when there's an issue is they contact that veterinarian and they say, hey, look, I need testing if they see something abnormal. For example, if they see respiratory issues and they suspect that it could be COVID, they contact our vet and then testing happens immediately. But and we've been pretty rigorous at it. They've, you know, all the farms that were identified with COVID was due to farmers reporting it.
Rigorous mean? Can you go into that?
Yeah. So when it, like, if we start at the beginning, so in 2020 in August is when, so the USDA announced that we had the first confirmed cases of COVID on mink farms, and it was one in Utah. So over the next few months, it was a total of 17 farms at that time that in the US that had tested positive for these cases. And I remember one of these farmers I was on the phone with, and I said, what does it look like? What's the process like?
Mm-hmm.
And he says, yeah, we have the CDC here, and they're in their hazmat suits, and they're walking through our farms testing mink, and they're observing. And he says, it looks like something you'd see on TV. Like it's a CDC zone where they're, you know, it's quarantined. So yeah, that's what that rigorous process looked like. And then we had follow-up tests as well, and which of all those farms tested negative down the road.
Is there mandatory testing for COVID on all mink farms? What is the status of that?
Yeah, that's a good question, because I think that's what's on the top of everyone's mind. So just to kind of set the stage, there hasn't been any variants of interest or of concern that have been found on mink farms.
Here in the US, or are you talking about Europe?
Yeah, I'd say, you know, I can't really speak for the European associations and farms, but for in the US, you know, we have multiple USDA agencies are doing research, not only in the mink, but other susceptible species like the white-tailed deer and mice to better understand it. But right now what we're doing to be part of the solution, you know, we're always wanting to be, you know, good citizens. And so the USDA, along with Fur Commission, we're in the process of developing guidance policies for a farm surveillance program. So the aim is to have the policies in place this year. And this program will be a joint effort between the USDA, the CDC, and state animal health organizations. Kind of a little bit of a pilot program is the state of Oregon. They've already established a farm surveillance program in the fall of 2021, which all the farms in Oregon were surveyed and tested, and they were found to be negative for the virus. So that's what we look for in the future, is so they can get a better understanding of this disease within
so
the meat population.
How often would inspectors go onto farms through this farm surveillance program, and how often are inspectors going on now?
Yeah, so right now in Oregon, if you look at what they're doing there, but it's usually around before the processing of before the harvest is when they do the inspections.
And that harvest is in the fall.
Yeah. Mm-hmm,
okay.
In the fall.
Uh-huh.
So, but the program we'll have now, it's still in the beginning stages, but it's been said that it will mimic essentially other agricultural surveillance programs. So what's that going to look like? I think those details are still to be ironed out, because I think this is a little bit of a unique situation. So I think that's to be heard.
Chalice Hobbs with us, Executive Director of Fur Commission USA. This is an organization representing U.S. mink farmers, Wisconsin leading the nation in mink pelt production. Taking your questions about the industry, about what has happened in COVID, 800-642-1234. One of our reporters, Hope Kerwin, spoke with Valerie Zimbel, who works for her family's mink farm in Sheboygan Falls. And here she is talking about what her farm is doing to protect workers and the mink against COVID.
We actually do more than what's required of us. You know, we vaccinated all of our mink twice, and they've been boosted, all paid for by the farmers.
So can you go into a little bit about the vaccination for mink and the vaccination for COVID? What is this, and how has it been carried out?
Yeah. So how this has played out is, so Zoetis, they're the world's largest producer of animal vaccines, and they developed and distributed a vaccine for mink. And so when they did that, it was early 2021. So since then, 95% of the U.S. mink population has been vaccinated against COVID. So more than, you know, the human population in the States. So it's pretty impressive. And what goes to credit, in my opinion, to these farmers is that they covered the cost 100%. So the vaccine has been shown to be safe. It's effective in mink. Due to the successful utilization of it. And they're actually, it's been interesting because they've used this vaccine after they've watched it and they tested it on mink, and now they're using it in non-human primates, lions, tigers, and in zoos. So it's kind of it's been a collaborative effort, monitored with the government and the CDC and USDA.
And the CDC says monitoring COVID outbreaks and variants in wildlife is now critical. How big of a concern are farmed mink interacting with wild animals and spreading COVID through that way?
Yeah, and I think this is a good question that comes up a lot. So if we look at the evidence and what's been done, so like Valerie said, there's mink farms have strict biosecurity measures and practices in place. We've even pre-COVID, it's always been necessary. In fact, a lot of these sheds, they have to have locks, they have to be able to be closed, perimeter fences to assure that, you know, nothing comes in and nothing's getting out. However, with that said, you know, nothing's perfect, and sometimes, you know, an animal can get loose. So if you look, they've trapped three mink outside of infected farms, and those mink tested positive for low levels of the virus. Since then, over 100 animals of various species have been trapped and tested in proximity of those positive farms with no detection of the virus. And there are no confirmed or suspected cases indicating that the COVID virus or related mutations spread from the farm mink.
State are you talking about here? Where this happened, or can you?
Yeah, this is Utah.
Utah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cause like in Utah, there was about 12 is where that's where it first broke, where they first saw the cases in COVID and mink.
So what happens, like when we saw Denmark, the largest European fur producer, the entire mink population, they called it 17 million animals called in the early stages of the pandemic. What has happened here on U.S. mink farms when there is an outbreak?
Yeah, you know, Denmark, and it's a little different too. So our industry, it's kind of difficult to compare with the Danish past mink industry. You know, Denmark they're producing almost 10 times the mink that the U.S. did in a land area about half the size of Maine. So within that small area, there were over 5 million people and 1,200 mink farms. And the U.S. has, you know, a little over 100 mink farms that are isolated in you know, outlying rural areas spread out through a dozen North American northern states. So in that sense, it is very different when you're looking at the bird's eye view of it. And the Minister of Ag over there in Denmark, you know, she was forced to resign over the legality of the move, and in the face of scientific evidence,
but
demonstrating
even,
there is a minimal risk.
Even there isn't an apples and apples compared, to Denmark. What is the policy here in the U.S. on our mink farms in the U.S. when there is an outbreak of COVID? Is the entire animal population on that farm culled?
No, they are not culled. There are quarantines and testing is what we do right now, and monitoring.
Chellis Hobbs with us leads the trade group Fur Committee, representing U.S. mink farmers with about 275-ish farms in 23 states, including the leader, Wisconsin. Still time to talk about the future of the mink industry. What you want to know about it, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Chellis Hobbs here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Health officials believe four people in Michigan infected with a COVID strain linked to mink are the first known animal-to-human transmissions here in the U.S. That was reporting this week in the Detroit Free Press. Additional reporting this morning out of New York Times, talking with the CDC, that samples of the virus collected from these four people contained two mutations that scientists have hypothesized maybe signs of adaptation to mink. Join in your questions, 800-642-1234. Chalice Hobbs leads the Industry Trade Group for Commission USA with us for about 10 more minutes. Let's bring in Lynn now in Westby. Hi, Lynn. What would you like to bring up?
Good morning. I know this tends to be a bit controversial, so I'll just head that off. But when I hear a word like cull or harvest, I think of plants, not mammals. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering if there's a more humane way to euthanize mink that are being harvested for fur or being culled because of a contagious disease.
Lynn, thank you for that question. Chalice.
Yeah, that's a good question. Thank you. And, you know, it'd be interesting to hear how people think that mink are harvested as well. But if we look how we do it, you know, I grew up on a mink farm and a cattle ranch, and we worked with the local dairymen and poultry people around our area. And so I've been around a lot of ag. So what we do in terms of harvesting is we actually do it according to the Animal Veterinarian Medical Association and their recommendations. So we euthanize all the mink farms in the U.S. use cooled, pure filtered carbon monoxide. So it puts them to sleep. And, you know, I've been on the farms and they do it, and it's actually a peaceful process watching it. They go in, and within a minute, they're expired. So And you contrast that to other forms of how animals are harvested. And in my opinion, it is humane how I've seen it done.
And this is sensitive. So do please take care as you listen. But there have also been electrocution methods. Are those used?
No. In the U.S., we do not use any electrocution. Other myths that are out there is that there's live skinning. We do not do that. That would be cruel and inhumane, and so we do not support any methods like live skinning and the such like that.
You know, as growing up in the industry on a mink farm, I'm wondering, do you see this as a legacy business, a legacy industry passed down through a family, generations, or do you see new people, new farmers going into mink farming?
Yeah, you know, I would say mostly it's legacy. It's not abnormal to see three generations working together on farms. You know, my family's farm was started by my great grandmother that had a dairy farm. And, you know, in Wisconsin, there's a lot of stories like that. And in fact, the most famous and most highly paid for mink pelts in the world come out of Wisconsin. So there is a very deep legacy. And then there's new guys jumping in too. I have three friends that are my age that have just started and they're in their 30s. So yeah, it's a little bit of both, but mostly legacy, I'd say.
As you look at what's happening in Europe, as you look at trade in mink pelts, we're seeing over 15 European countries have introduced legislation to ban or phase out mink farming. What does that mean for the market here in the U.S., and is the U.S. far behind?
You know, in terms of market, it comes down to supply and demand. So that's what dictates the market. And our biggest market for U.S. producers is exports, just like a lot of ag. You know, a lot of it's being exported to, and our main market is Asia. Followed by Russia and Ukraine. So, which culturally and they accept and they use and they love animal products, and we're happy to supply them. But the other thing that we do to make sure we can give our consumers assurance that what we're doing is good is that we have, we've always had animal welfare at the top of our minds. And, you know, we have, humane standards and certification programs that are applicable for all U.S. producers. And they've been peer reviewed by PACO, which is the, you know, they're the Professional Animal Auditor Certification Organization. And so it's an international team of animal welfare experts have certified our certification program. And then farms are third party inspected by Validus assure compliance.
Yeah. I want to jump in here. When you say your major export markets are Asia, Russia, Ukraine, and I'm wondering about the impact of sanctions on Russia. I'm wondering about the war, Russia's war on Ukraine. What impact will that have on mink farmers across the U.S. and here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, it does impact it. Like I said, it all comes down to supply and demand. In 2021, just to give you an idea, mink pellet prices increased over 100% over the previous year. And the season before that, mink prices increased 60%. So the market's cyclical and it was on its way up, but with the, you know, with COVID shutdowns in Asia and China mostly, and then you look at this, you know, this terrible Ukraine-Russia conflict, it is impacting sales. And that's something we are monitoring, and it's yet to play out, but it definitely will affect demand.
I would imagine that come the harvest time, that would significantly affect where you can export your product, your mink pelts to. I mean, that would have a huge effect, especially amid the sanctions to Russia.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. Like luxury goods, mink's considered a luxury good, and that is one of the things that has sanctions on it for Russia right now.
Let's go to Becky in Hustisford. Becky, hi.
Oh, hello. Thank you for taking my call. I know we're right near the end. I just wanted to comment on the fact that I deeply respect my friends who are vegan and who are Buddhist, and the dilemma of using animals for any kind of consumptive product is something that each one of us has to morally deal with. But sometimes we have a tendency to focus on things like fur and find that abhorrent, and yet turn around and eat a hamburger with great gusto or consume meat on a regular basis. One thing that often isn't focused on is the fact that furs are a consumable, renewable resource that don't produce PFAS. They don't produce plastics that would become microplastics in the environment.
And Becky, thank you. We are out of time, but Chalice, a few moments here to respond to Becky.
Yeah, you know, I would just like to echo that. You know, in Wisconsin alone, the mink farmers consume over 1 million pounds of byproduct that is not consumable by humans. Over 25 million of that is Wisconsin cheese that's not fit for human consumption. So yes, they are recyclable and the fur garments are biodegradable, but they can last for generations. So I agree with her. It's a great renewable resource.
Chalice, thank you for joining us.
Yeah.
Chalice Hobbs is Executive Director of Fur Commission USA. It's a trade group for U.S. mink farmers. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.